Hello. Here is your KVNF regional newscast for Tuesday, August 7th. Signatures are in for a number of statewide ballot questions, hoping to make it to voters this November, including one to increase the distance between oil and gas wells from homes and schools. From Rocky Mountain Community Radio Exchange member KUNC, Matt Bloom has more.
Colorado Rising supporters hand-delivered more than 171,000 signatures to the Colorado Secretary of State's office on Monday. Ann Lee Foster is one of the campaign's lead organizers. She says increased industry encroachment on homes and schools is driving the effort.
People are not wanting that and are sick of the brazen disregard for their voice in the matter, and so they are incredibly supportive of this initiative.
If passed, Initiative 97 would increase new well setbacks from 500 feet to 2,500 feet, a move the oil and gas industry calls an effective ban on development. Colorado Rising needs at least 98,000 verified signatures to qualify. The Secretary of State's office has until September 5th to go through them. For KUNC, I'm Matt Bloom.
Coloradans who get SNAP benefits will soon be required to get a job. But a new study says that if politicians want to see more people working more hours, cutting their food stamp benefits won't get the job done. Eric Galatis has more.
As the U.S. House and Senate try to hammer out a final version of the Farm Bill, a new report shows that increasing work requirements for people receiving SNAP benefits, the program formerly known as food stamps, would end up hurting millions of Americans. Josh Bivens, with the Economic Policy Institute and the report's lead author, says the move proposed in the House version of the bill would not increase employment levels, and he says additional requirements would be especially hard on people working in low-paying jobs.
You can have a lot of people trying hard to meet it, and they're just not going to meet it, and they're going to have their benefits taken away from them, really through no fault of their own, but just because the low-wage labor market does not provide steady, well-paid employment.
Bivens says most SNAP recipients who can work already have at least one job, but frequently can't get enough hours to meet the requirements. He adds that most low-wage jobs don't come with family leave benefits, so workers often risk losing jobs to stay home to care for a sick family member. Proponents of the new requirements claim SNAP and other safety net programs create government dependency and encourage unemployment. Bivens disagrees that the average monthly SNAP benefit, $125 per person in food vouchers, is an incentive to stop working. He says the vast majority of recipients, seniors, children, and people with disabilities, are not people he believes most Americans would agree should be forced into work.
Of the people who are, you know, not in those groups, don't have a disability, are not retired, are not children, the majority of them who receive food stamps do work. And so this idea that we've made this safety net too comfortable for people, I think, just radically overestimates how generous it really is.
Currently, SNAP recipients younger than 50 and without children or a disability must work at least 80 hours per month to get benefits. Under the House proposal, people younger than 60, even if they have young children, would lose benefits if they don't log at least 100 hours a month. This is Eric Galatis reporting for the Colorado News Connection.
The U.S. Geological Survey keeps track of how much water flows through rivers and streams across the country to help plan for shortages, or at the other extreme, brace for floods. But there are more waterways than the agency is able to track. So recently, they added new tools that will not only help them cover more ground, but also help them learn more about this precious resource. Yesterday, we heard about sensors in the Arkansas River. Today, Franny Halperin from H2O Radio has part two of this story, which talks about how drones monitor water supply.
The big advantage of using a drone over a manned aircraft is that you take the human factor out of it, right? No one gets hurt, everybody goes home at the end of the day.
That's Todd Burton, who is assisting Fulton today, and someone who might possibly have one of the coolest jobs ever.
I work for the U.S. Geological Survey's National Unmanned Aircraft Project Office in Denver, and the majority of my work is flying unmanned aircraft and then processing the data that we collect from those aircraft.
Yep, he flies drones for a living. Well, it's more than that. He's in charge of a fleet of remotely piloted aircraft, which range from small quadcopters to fixed-wing aircraft to even unmanned helicopters for larger payloads. So how does he decide which aircraft to use for which job?
The size of the area of the project is a determining factor. All of our aircraft run off of batteries. They're not gas-powered. So we're usually anywhere from 10 to 45 minutes, depending on the aircraft. Of course, if you have a manned helicopter, you could stay up for hours and get larger swaths of land done.
The weather is a determining factor, too. He can't fly in strong winds like manned aircraft can. Also, it's over 100 degrees out here today. And because we're about a mile above sea level, the air pressure and heat make the aircraft think it's at 10,000 feet. And that's too much for these little guys to get off the ground. Also, Burton says he has to factor in the curious public. A small, low-flying drone wouldn't grab the attention that a hovering helicopter would.
We're right next to a highway. We're over a river. We're in a canyon. There's lots of factors here that you want to look at if you were in, a manned helicopter. Be going low and slow. With the highway here, get a lot of looky-loos that can cause accidents.
The ability of a drone to hover close to the ground gives it an advantage over manned aircraft. Plus, it's a lot cheaper than having a scientist rent a plane. USGS is continuing to develop new sensors and cameras to put on its fleet and sending them to places that were previously hard to reach.
We have a drone with a hyperspectral camera on it, and we'll be testing it later this summer, but the thought is that you may be able to judge the amount of sediment and water. There's also something called green LIDAR, which is essentially a laser that can penetrate through water. So we don't know if any of this works yet, but that's part of our job, is to assist the scientists to see if we can make it work, and if not, what can we change to get it to work correctly.
The wish list from scientists is growing every day, Burton says. For example, they're testing cameras that are multispectral that can look at different wavelengths to allow scientists to judge the amount of water stress in plants, something that would be useful in agriculture.
People just are dreaming up stuff every day. We have folks that want to try and use a ground penetrating radar system on one. And just sort of looking at all different types of things. If you can think it up and somebody can shrink it down, then we can probably get it on the aircraft.
Yes, it's all about minimizing because the aircraft can only carry so much weight. But no one is minimizing the potential of these new tools to give us a whole new perspective on the world around us. For H2O Radio, I'm Franny Halperin.
And that was your KVNF Regional Newscast for Tuesday, August 7th. For KVNF News, I'm Eric Gould. Thanks so much for listening.